Welcome, everybody. We just wanted to say one thing about the song this morning. It's called In the Temple of Isis, and it was written by Swami Kriyananda. And Isis is a in the ancient Egyptian tradition, a representative of Divine Mother. So we hope that you all, during this song, feel like you are in the Temple of Isis.
Still your mind if you want to pray. Send all cares far away. Sing then, love's ever near. Isis comes, await the day. Isis comes, await the day. Mother comes, await the day.
Stay your mind if you want to pray. Send all cares far away. Sing then, love's ever near. Isis comes, await the day.
Send all cares far away. Sing then, love's ever near. Isis comes, await the day. Isis comes, await the day. Mother comes, await the day.
Comes, await the day. Isis
I'm not going to do the usual Sunday service. I'll talk for, I hope not too long. I'm not one of those people who has no concern for the poor public. And then I'll let you ask questions, and then Kalyani will sing us a song based on a poem that I wrote many years ago. This thing of ISIS is a very interesting thing, because I went to Egypt and I wrote these songs on, about Egypt after being there, and it's interesting. Near the Temple of Isis, it's all sand now, but I had a very clear recollection of it being all green. And there was an ashram there that I lived in, and the whole culture, instead of being stone friezes and so on, suddenly took on a real life for me. And I realized this was a living culture. So anyway, that was a very interesting experience for me. And my subject today is what is it again? Can God be found through the intellect? The answer, when I wrote that title, was no. Now it is semi-no. I have to realize that I myself found God, or I should say I didn't find him, found the way to God, the importance of God, the fact that he exists, the reality of the spiritual path. I found it, in a sense, through the intellect, not through the heart. I wish I had found it through the heart. I would have liked that. The path of love is much sweeter. But I was determined to understand truth with my mind. I didn't believe in God. I didn't think that there could be a God. At least I did not like the God that they were telling me about in church. It's not that he seemed too dictatorial. He just seemed so boring. I couldn't see any point in him. And so I tried through astronomy, I tried through political systems, I tried through arts and so on. But every path that I tried, I realized that it just is not going to give people what they want. First of all, then I wanted to become a playwright. And I realized that, yes, I might have a gift for playwriting, but so what? I didn't know truth. What was the point in flooding the world with my ignorance? And so I decided to quit playwriting. I wanted to give people truth, and I didn't know what truth was. And I realized that the only people who have really helped humanity over a long period of time have been Jesus Christ, Buddha. I didn't know anything about Krishna, but the spiritual leaders in the world. And I realized there's got to be something to all this God business. And so I remember taking a long walk out into the night in Charleston, where I was studying playwriting. And I asked myself, if there's a God, what must he be? Well, he can't be a judge. He can't be an old man with a long white beard. He can't be somebody who's willing to, sort of waiting for you to make a mistake so he can clap you into hell. There's got to be something more. And I realized, what makes me ask this question? If I were just a robot, as some scientists have tried to claim, then I could never have been programmed to ask this question. It's never been a part of my life. He has to be intelligence, and I have to be intelligently a part of him. And then the purpose of life has to be to I notice that there are times in my life when I'm more aware than other times. For instance, if I've had a few beers, I'm not as aware. And sometimes I'm much more aware. And I realized then that I had stood on the shore near my apartment in Charleston and watched the ocean come in. And there were rocks on the beach, and the distance between the rocks determined how much water was coming in. And if that is so, then the more I open myself to that intelligence, the more will come in. And therefore, there can only be one purpose in life, and that is to seek God. And I vowed from then on to seek him. I, after a little bit of time, began to wonder, am I going crazy? I didn't think that anybody had ever sought God. I knew there were these people who had taught about him, but the thought of seeking God, am I going mad? I thought maybe what I need is to go out into the country, and so I tried that. And I remember seeing the beautiful rainbow in a dewdrop, in the sunlight. And I thought, that is beautiful, but I can't feel it. What's the matter with me? I'm like a motor working on one cylinder. I've got to change this. And so I realized that nature isn't going to do it for me. I have to do it for myself. I have to change myself. And I came to the understanding that whether I go crazy or not, this is the only thing I can do with my life. And my father had been sent by his company, Esso, to Egypt to find oil there. I'm certain it was all God's doing, because he never was left there. He found where oil would be found. Mobile went in and found oil there, but they took my father out and sent him to France. And there he got a Legion of Honor and all that stuff. But Egypt, he didn't need to go there. The day I put my mother on the ship to go join him was the day I found Autobiography of a Yogi. I didn't know anything about Indian philosophy. Yes, a few weeks before I'd learned something about it. But really, basically, I was completely ignorant. And I read this book, and it absolutely changed my life. I saw that he was a vegetarian. All right, I would be a vegetarian. What made me believe in him? Here's where the intellect shows its deficiency. I couldn't believe some of the things he wrote in that book. I had to put them on a shelf. The idea of miracles, my mother had tried to talk to me about miracles, and I said, come off it, mother. There's nothing. This is nonsense. But he had talked about it, and there was something about his vibrations. I can't explain it, but there was something that was absolutely compelling for me. And I knew he was right. I knew that of all the people I had ever met, he was somebody who knew what he was talking about. And everything that he said, I determined I would follow. And I took after finishing that book, the next bus from New York to Los Angeles. And when I met him, I said words to him that I had never imagined speaking to anybody. I said, I want to be your disciple. And I've been that ever since. He accepted me that same day. And it was a very strange interview. Some people have said, what was your impression of him? I couldn't have an impression of him. I already had my impression. But I was just absolutely praying, this is the most important thing I've ever asked. You just got to accept me. You've got. And he read me in silence for quite a long time. And then he said, you have a good karma. You may join us. And I said, well, I don't have to come right away. And he said, no, you can come. And I was really desperate. And he had me kneel down. And no, first of all, he gave me his unconditional love. Now, that's something I can hardly imagine. And he said, do you give me that love too? And I said, yes, I do. Then he made a request to me that I didn't feel prepared for. He said, will you give me your unconditional obedience? And I had to be truthful. So I said to him, but what if I think you're wrong sometime? And he said, I will never ask anything of you that God himself does not tell me to ask you. So I said, all right, in that case, I give you my unconditional love, obedience. And then he had me kneel in front of him, and he put his hand over my heart like that, and it was vibrating violently for about 2 minutes. And I just was changed by that. And somehow, everything I can say has been that I've found worthwhile in life has been since meeting him and since that meeting. A year later, he put me in charge of the monks. He used to tell me, you have a great work to do. The first time he said that, I was standing with a brother disciple whom he was sending to Phoenix to be the minister there. And he was giving me a little last-minute advice, giving him, I should say, a little last-minute advice. And then he paused a bit, and then he said, you have a great work to do. And I looked at him felicitatingly. And Master looked at me, he said, it's you I'm talking to, Walter. He used to call me Walter. And from then on, he often said that. One time he said to me, apart from St. Lin, his main disciple, every man has disappointed me. And you mustn't disappoint me. And he spoke with great power. And I knew he didn't mean that men had disappointed him spiritually. He had some wonderful men disciples. But apparently what all of them had done was come to him thinking in terms of their own salvation. Whereas I had this intense desire to share his teachings with other people. And I guess that's why he said that. Because my life has been dedicated to that. You know, when I was thrown out on my ear in New York, that was in 1962, I was 36 years old. And, it seemed at the time the worst experience of my life. I hadn't imagined this could happen. Now I have to say it was the most fortunate experience of my life. Everything I've been able to do since then has been since my being on my own. I've been able to write books. I've been able to write music. I've been able to paint. I've been able to take photographs. I've been able to start 8 communities. And you may say it's at least it's kept him off the streets. But really, I have to say that I'm so grateful for this life. Here I am nearly 85, and I still feel there's so much I can still do. I'm making movies now. It sounds absurd. But I'm hardly Clark Gable. But anyway, It's actually been great fun. And Ted here has been interviewing me and asking me very good questions. A large part of a good interview is the questions that are asked. And yesterday I was on the radio. Was it Friday I was on the radio? And the lady asked me, Lisa Garr, she asked me many very good questions. It was a pleasure. I could answer them. When somebody asks me a stupid question, I can't be stupid in my answer, but I can't be intelligent either. So anyway, you know, there was one time Master used to say, get devotion, get devotion. I was too intellectual. And one time I got very angry with him. The only time I got angry with him, he told me to work on developing devotion, and then he gave me a job that was entirely intellectual. And I thought, well, that's not fair. Yet later I realized he didn't want me to become stupid. He just wanted me to balance intellect with devotion. The two have to work together. But living with him, I have to say it was the most fantastic experience. I've had a chance to meet other saints, and I don't believe in comparisons. Unless you're making an important choice, then you have to compare. But in my case, I'd made my choice. I don't mean it as a comparison. I just mean that he was, in his way, he was extraordinary. He wore his wisdom like a comfortable old jacket. He had a wonderful sense of humor. Most people, when they present him, try to present him as very grave, very wise, very everything that I thought a sage would be, but this one wasn't. I mean, for example, he had such a good laugh over, your teeth are like stars, they come out at night. He could have so much fun with jokes. There was one that he told, I may have shared this with some of you, but it was an Irishman, an Englishman, and a Scotchman who were drinking whiskey, and a fly fell into each of their glasses, and the Irishman sort of sloshed his whiskey, and half the whiskey went out along with the fly, and the Englishman carefully flicked the fly out. And I remember the fun with which Masters concluded, and the Scotchman squeezed the fly. But he was also very devotional. That was the difference really between him and Sri Yukteswar. But as Sri Yukteswar said, you can't take one step toward God without developing the natural love of the heart. And so Master, who had that love, was also very wise. And I was with him during the period when he was expressing great wisdom. And for me, it was just thrilling. I remember he was interpreting, commenting on the Bhagavad Gita. I said when I read it, sir, this is the greatest thing I've ever read in my life. And he said it's because it's from God. But then we would walk around the compound at the lake shrine. It was sort of a fenced-in enclosure. And sometimes he would just actually sway, and I'd have to hold him to keep him from falling. And he said, it's so difficult to know which body I'm supposed to keep moving. I'm in all bodies, but yet I have to keep this one body moving. This is the extent of the ego in an enlightened sage. But he was also so completely natural, like with his jokes. One thing that really impressed me was the great respect he showed for everybody. And he was humble in the sense of being completely non-existent. He didn't feel that he... When I looked into his eyes, there was just space there. I don't mean suddenly there was blank, But I mean, there was no sense of ego. There was no attachment. When he responded to you, he didn't respond with emotions. He didn't have any likes and dislikes. But you felt this deep love from him. I remember one time, I used to be very nearsighted. I had an eye operation, so I can see very well now, so I don't think you can get away with anything. But then I couldn't. And I was at the other end of the room, just about to leave, and he looked at me, and I felt this flood of love coming over me. It was just so beautiful. And then I remember one time a little group of us there, two or three of the boys were out, their job was to fill in the potholes in the driveway. And we'd had a heavy rain, as often happens in February and March. And he was telling them about how to fill in the potholes and so on. So I wasn't involved. You know, I never could close my eyes in his presence because he kept looking at me. I wished sometimes he wouldn't so that I could close my eyes, but I couldn't because he wouldn't let me. But this time I could. And I closed my eyes and I felt these waves of bliss coming from him. It was incredible. I remember one man, he had been scolding. He didn't scold ever with personal feeling. But sometimes he did scold. It's sort of like if you have a child, a little six-year-old child walks out into traffic. Are you going to say, "Now, Johnny, come back, you might get run over"? You're going to grab him by the scruff of the neck and give him a few wallops on the bottom and make him really listen. This is the sort of thing you mustn't do. And you do it with love. But he did scold people sometimes strongly. Once or twice he scolded me strongly. Some people resented it or felt he was very cruel or harsh or hard disciplinarian. I never felt that at all. I would look into his eyes and I'd see this deep regret that he had to speak this way to make his point. But on the other hand, he spoke with so much love. There was one time, I've mentioned this in my book, The New Path, where one of the monks was up in the third floor interview room and a nun was at the other end of the room. And he was really giving her a good scolding. You'd have thought the roof would come off. Every time he had his back to her and he'd look at the monk, he'd wink and then turn back like this. But he didn't have any feeling like that. I would see in his eyes just the regret that he had to speak strongly. He told me, "I prefer to discipline with the eyes. I just wilt when I have to speak more strongly." But he was there to help us to find God. And that meant getting rid of our delusions. And this was a Herculean task. Delusions are basically all of them are rooted in the thought that I am separate from you and from you. I'm not. It's all one. The same God is dreaming all of us. And there's no difference between you and me. It's a very wonderful concept when you can get used to it. But until you do, you think, "Well, gosh, well, who am I?" and so on. But finally, in his presence, you began to learn these things. Much of what he taught had nothing to do with words. It was rather his vibration. And you would feel this vibration. It was life-changing. One, if you want to tune in to somebody like that, here's a technique to do that which will help you. This is the sort of broadcasting station in the body, the point between the eyebrows. It's not the bone structure there. It's really in the frontal lobe of the brain between that point, below, behind that point. But use that and send this thought. Have a picture of him, for example, and look at his eyes, and then try to feel his eyes and feel his answer in the heart. The heart is the receiving set. And in this point, you can feel the guidance. And I've lived by that guidance. I found again and again in my life that when I ask the question, should I, the answer comes, either yes or no. I remember writing a letter one time to somebody, and there was a little, one of those letters that you aren't sure whether you should write or not. And I had a few things to say, and I thought they might help him, but would he be ready for them? Was it wise? I wasn't sure. And I felt a nervousness here. So I thought, no, all right, I won't send it. But when you do this, I remember just a little example that I've talked about recently. When I was, Virginia Scharfman owned East West Bookstore in Menlo Park. And she one time asked me, would you like to buy the shop? And I said, well, maybe, who knows? I didn't think she was serious, so I didn't pay any attention really. But the next time I came into that shop, my parents lived near there, and so I visited that area. And the next time I came in, she said, would you like to buy it? Much more seriously. And I said, do you mean it? She said, yes, I'm getting old. I'm 75. It's time for me to retire. I would like to sell it to somebody who would appreciate my ideals. And so at that point, then I asked Master here, should I buy it? And I felt here, yes, I should. So I told her yes. Now, he didn't have the money. The first thing you need if you want to buy a shop is the money, isn't it? I didn't have the money. She wanted $45,000 down payment. That was a big sum. But I just completely confidently said yes. And a couple of weeks later, I think I had a little over 2 weeks to wait to pay the down payment, somebody sent me a gift of $37,000. Somebody else gave $10,000. We had enough somehow. And when the day came, we had enough to buy that shop. And really, miracles have not stopped since he died. They've continued. You know, one time I had a kidney stone attack, and it was Sunday morning, and I was giving the service at the retreat there, at the temple there in Ananda Village. And at 9 o'clock, I got this kidney stone attack. Women who have had children say that this is much more painful than childbirth. And besides, there's nothing to show for it. my body was shaking like a leaf. There was just nothing I could do about it. And I couldn't, they wanted to take me to the hospital. I couldn't bear the thought of all those curves going down. And so I'd never pray for myself, so I didn't pray for myself. But when I looked at my watch, finally it said 10:45, and I was still shaking like a leaf. And I thought, well, I said to Divine Mother, Mother, if you want me to give this service, you're going to have to do something about this pain. Do you know, it was just like, within a second it was gone. And it was replaced by a joy that was so intense I could hardly speak. So God is still there. Guru is still there. This is not a path that is for intellectuals. This is not a path that is just for heart people. This is the path for people who really love God and want to know him. God is a reality in this life. God is the main reality, is the reason that we are coming into a very great depression. And we are. It'll be much worse than the 1930s. Many people will not only not have jobs, which, you know, the official government figures are that the unemployment is 9.4%. The actual figures are 22.4% and rising. This is no joke. We're going to have great suffering ahead of us. People will be starving. Well, at this time, it's because people have forgotten God. You know, one good thing about it is that back in the first Depression, it made people think more in terms of us four and no more, us and our family. This time it's going to turn people more toward God. This will be the good thing that will come out of it. People will realize that this is the only solution to life, and it is. It thrills me to be able to share these teachings. And the one good thing about it is that with the Indian teachings coming into America, Americans, this is what saint in India, what was his name? Ramatirtha. He came to America and he said, someday you Americans will take this yoga science and make it practical and bring it back to my people. And what I have found is that when these teachings have been brought to this country, we have to make sense out of them. And we've made sense out of them so that we can explain them much more clearly. For example, the Indian teachings tell you that everything is based on duality. On the other hand, they say that everything is a mixture of the three gunas, three qualities, darkening, middle, and activating, and good. Well, how can there be two and three? Doesn't make any sense. I mean, it should be one or the other. But in fact, it is both. Because the middle, the activating one, it's sort of like a wave. You've got the low wave, which is sattvaguna. You've got the high wave, which is tamaguna. You have that push upward, which is activating. But there are really only two qualities, the lower and the upper. It's still duality, but you've got the movement between the two, and that movement is that third guna. So again and again, you'll find that the American mentality, because it's more logical, it likes to put things together and make sense out of them. And so it challenges us. And Yogananda, in his explanations too, took that mentality into account and made sense of it by showing that all these teachings are really founded in a fundamental truth. You know, one of the wonderful things about yoga is that it's not some strange, exotic, unimaginable reality. It's based on simple truths. For example, everybody, now you're not sitting straight. It says, I don't want to embarrass you, I'm just joking. But when you keep your spine straight, the energy can move more clearly in the spine. When the energy moves upward, every country in the world says the same thing. I feel uplifted, or I feel depressed. I feel high, or I feel down. It's universal. Nobody says, well, I feel great. It doesn't happen. The truths are universal. Everybody, when he wants to think deeply, sort of goes like that, knits his eyebrows. One time there was a dog next door to Master's Desert Retreat, and this dog used to come around, and when we were having lunch out of doors, the dog came there, and Master said, look at the wrinkle in his forehead. He's so concentrated on this food that all his attention is here. Well, this is a universal truth. When you feel a love disappointed, betrayed, whatever it might be, you never say, I have a broken knee. You may say, I have a broken heart. It's the truth of it. When you feel, this is another thing, that when you see people who are proud, well, first of all, let me say, well, no, all right, I'll go this way. When you feel, find somebody who's very proud, he sort of, he looks down his nose, we say. But the truth is, there's tension back here that has drawn his head back. And why is the universal gesture in all countries, whether it be the darkest Africa or the most distant Siberia, whatever it might be, in all countries, the gesture of humility is a bow? What does it mean? What makes us automatically do that? Because we feel that we're relaxing the tension here and offering it, offering ourselves. This is universal. And when you feel the rising energy, you feel it coming to here. That's why when you see pictures of saints, they're often depicted looking up. That's where the eyes naturally are drawn. There was a painting I saw in the window of a drugstore, and it depicted a young man dreaming of the glorious future as a pharmacologist or a pharmacist. How would they depict him? Like that or like that? Obviously like that. I don't know how glorious that future would be, but they had to show him looking up because he was supposed to feel aspiration. Aspiration always is upward. So there are certain truths that are universal. And when we follow those truths, yoga is wonderful in simply developing things we all know and showing us how these things can be realized. So I won't go deeply into that one, although I could. For example, in fact, I will. You know, when you see a beautiful sunset and you feel inspired by it, you look up, you inhale. Isn't that right? When you see something you don't like, you tend to exhale. Now, it isn't the thing that makes you that way. It's your reaction to it. So yoga says, look at your reaction. That's where your reality is. This is where you're really feeling joy. This is where you're really feeling unhappy. This is what you have to take into account. And there are two currents in the spine that automatically affect that feeling. When you feel good about something, the energy goes upward. When you feel badly, it goes downward. And when the energy comes up, there's an automatic inhalation. Oh, how wonderful. And you inhale. And when it goes down, you sigh. The energy goes out. The breath goes out. Everything. There's a tie between the breath and the currents in the spine. And that's the essence of Kriya Yoga. Now, all these things are absolutely fascinating when you realize that with the American clarification of these things, because sometimes they're no longer talked about in India. In America, we need to have it really spelled out for us. It's wonderful how this ancient teaching is so practical. So again and again, the importance is that you use your heart above all. Without love, you can't find God. But on the other hand, stupid people will never find God. You have to have the intellect also. It doesn't have to be high intellect, but really it has to be, you've got to have some brains after all. By the way, some of you went to Encinitas and the monk there told you that the temple was, it hadn't fallen. Master knew that it would fall and took those things out. That's not the truth. I can speak. I'm the oldest living disciple, I think, just about. And anyway, it had fallen. It hadn't fallen into the ocean. It had slipped down the slope, and it was already ruined as a structure that could be used. And then Master took all those things. He was able to save those things. But it wasn't something he took out because he knew it would happen. There is a poem that he wrote in Whispers from Eternity. I wish I had brought it with me. But he talked, do you have? Yeah, but I wouldn't find it that quickly either. All right, well, look for the poem. All right. Thank you. You know, I made a drawing for the cover of this thing. This is not my drawing. I like my drawing. I like it enough to have included it here. But I felt this was better. So I said, no, we can't put mine on the cover now. We have to put this. It's just absolutely fitting. Anyway, this poem, if I can find it. I mean, look at the... I'm supposed to find this? No, it's the last... Okay, 1, 5, 4. Okay, I'm lucky to have found it. In disease or in health, in success or in failure, in poverty or in prosperity, in joy or in sorrow, in disaster or in safety, in life or in death, I stand immutably, unalterably, unshakably loyal, devoted, and firmly loving Thee, my Heavenly Father, forever, forever, and forever. Master wrote this poem after the loss of that temple in Encinitas. And so now I'm going to stop fairly soon here. I want to give you a chance to ask questions. And here I am ready to put your nickel in the slot now. Davy, have you a Kleenex? Has anybody a Kleenex?
I was wondering what your plans are after leaving the ashram. I think it was said...
Sorry.
It's okay. After leaving the ashram, where is your work going to take you? Back to Ananda Village or
what are your plans,
just movies?
What are your plans after... You finish here in a couple of weeks.
I won't finish here. I have to come back here in at the end of May because I'm doing two movies. One is on the life of Yogananda, and I have to be here to tell people how to behave, to look like him, be like him, and so on. And maybe me, I don't know. But I'll have to come back in June. So what are my plans? I guess that depends on the director. I have no idea how much time he wants me to be here. I think that my work on this film will be over soon. Do you think so? You know, I have a desire. I wrote a script also for... I'll tell you the whole story. It's quite fun. I had... started to read The Wizard of Oz for no other purpose than just idle interest. I expected no inspiration, diversion, maybe, but not necessarily. I got as far as the Yellow Brick Road, which was right at the beginning of the book. And all of a sudden, this thing hit me that I should write a children's story. And so I did. And in 2 weeks, it just was given to me on a platter. In 2 weeks, I wrote 180 pages. And I have hardly changed it at all. And I have to say, I absolutely love it. It's proved to be a wonderful opportunity to bring in deep spiritual teachings. And what it is that I and my younger brother were, I was born in Romania, as you probably know, and lived there for the first 13 years of my life, although I went away to school in Switzerland and in England. And we used to come back here every, because my parents were American, every few years. But in the Transylvanian Alps, there were lots of forests around the place where we used to go for vacation. And so I visualized going into this forest and coming upon a ruin. And we went into the ruin and discovered that there were files on time. And I thought, well, what do they do? What do they mean? It turned out that they were talking about time not being linear, but circular, that now is the eternal now is at the center, and the actual time is in a rotary movement, not straight. And I was fascinated by this concept, and they went out, and they happened to notice that there was a dinosaur on the ground outside this ruined laboratory. And they went to it. They found that it was mostly skeleton, but there were still some pieces of flesh on it. How is this possible? Dinosaurs lived 64 million years ago. And so anyway, they didn't know what to do with this one. And they found that in a back room there was a tunnel. And the name of this book is The Time Tunnel. And they went in this tunnel, and they went down and down and became smaller and smaller, and finally dust particles became like huge boulders, and they got smaller and smaller, and finally atoms seemed like stars and planets and so on. And finally they came out the other end with a sphere on them, like a zero, as if to attain timelessness you have to become nothing as far as the ego is concerned. And they emerged into this beautiful meadow, and there was lovely scenery all around. And then they saw that there was this man lying on the ground there, and they came over to him, sort of willed their little sphere to go over to him. They were in one sphere because they'd clutched hands in fear. And when they came there, They couldn't wake the man up, but then they said dinosaur somehow. And as soon as he heard that word, he woke up. And he said, oh, my God, it's terrible. What happened? And they said, they explained the dinosaur was dead. And he said, oh, my God, thank God. He said, I had just come back. And he said, what year is this? 1935. Oh, my God, I've been here 5 years and didn't even know it. You see, it was timelessness. So 5 years would be nothing. And he had gone in 1930, back 64 million years ago to the time of the dinosaurs. And he'd made a point of coming out of his sphere. As long as you're in your sphere, no one will see you, no one will hear you. But you can roll it down, and he showed them how to raise it around them or lower it. And then as you come out of it, he came up onto the back of this dinosaur and was riding around. It was lots of fun looking down on everything from that great height. And all of a sudden, a Tyrannosaurus Rex came charging. Not at him. He was just a tiny little flea. But the dinosaur. And in his fear, he came out of this thing, and he had his legs clutching this dinosaur, which is why the dinosaur came with him. And he Let's see. Yes, this is it. His father had taught him. He said he went forward in time from 1930 to the time when we had jet airplanes that could break the sound barrier. And he said, you remember that time when we saw a jet plane break the sound barrier? He said, well, there's also such a thing as the time barrier. And if you go too quickly, then there's an explosion. And he says, I don't know what that explosion is like. I wouldn't want to be around. Just be very careful. Well, he said, I forgot his instructions in my anxiety to get away from the Tyrannosaurus Rex. And I rushed out of that period, and there was this explosion. And it occurred back at the time, at the entrance to our time tunnel. And the dinosaur in this explosion was thrown forward, and I was thrown backward. And I'm so grateful the dinosaur was killed. I was only stunned. And I lay there unconscious now for 5 years. And then he began taking them to different periods of time. And they went back to the time of William Tell. They went back to Egypt. They went back to Atlantis. And they went back to the time of Diogenes and the Greeks. And they went back to Syracuse when Plato, Plato had his theory about an ideal republic, which to me was ridiculous. And they went back to this one ruler who had tried to put his thing into practice, and it was a complete failure. So they went back there too. And then they went back to the time of William the Conqueror, and not him, but of a peasant in his dukedom. So it was great fun, and they learned many lessons. They said they wished they could change history, but they couldn't. History could change them. They couldn't change history. But love was something they could change. For example, there was one woman who was very loving to the Atlantis, and because of that, there could be a time change. They could affect her. Anyway, then they went forward. They went to Satya Yuga, the golden age of wisdom. And there were no cities then, just... anyway, it's all fascinating. And then they went forward 1,000 years from the present time. And there Hansel fell in love with a girl. And he decided to stay there. And they said, but you can't stay in the time period, you're stuck. And he said, no, I've learned that love can change. With love, I can change. And so he remained with her, and he brought new methods of teaching to their school and so on. Quite exciting anyway, and I had great fun. So I'd like to make that a movie. We'll see. We'll see. Yes.
So I have a question.
Can you wait for the microphone?
Oh.
We're streaming. No need.
I think he can hear you.
They're streaming the video.
Okay. So my question is, and I've heard you mention it twice at two different things, is the oncoming depression that you mentioned being worse than the 1930s. So then in a practical application, we should not really have much of any currency, and we should only mostly own farmland and precious metals, ideally.
That's exactly right.
And how much, I mean, maybe these things are subject to change, but what's the time frame on that? How quickly should one...
I think that this year may see a serious disintegration. At any rate, I know it's coming. And farmland, I would say more than farmland. Be with other people. People, we're people kind of people. we need each other. I myself, as a writer, I don't know how to build a building. I hit a nail and I have to hit at it 9 times before I actually hit it. And when I do hit it, it usually bends over. We need others. People, at Ananda, we have enough people there so that any need that comes up, somebody's an expert. Not only that, but it's much more fun having people around you. And especially it's fun having people who believe the same things you do, who share your ideals. So I do believe. Now, this is my own fancy. Mind you, it's not a prophecy. I'm repeating things Yogananda said, but this is not something he said, although he did imply it, that the cities of today will be gone. I mean, if there's a, if somebody's going to drop an atom bomb on the West Coast, is he going to drop it on Mount Shasta or on Los Angeles? Seems pretty obvious. I don't like to say it, but it does seem obvious. There are about 35,000 stockpiled atomic weapons. Right now, Pakistan is stockpiling more, and there are others that are not known. Certainly, sooner or later, somebody's going to drop an atomic bomb, which will mean a retaliation, not with sticks and stones, with atom bombs. We're going to see a terrible, terrible wars. I remember when I was in Cambodia, this was in 1958, and I felt there was a dark cloud over the country. When I went to Germany, I felt there was a dark cloud over Germany. Not as dark, I want to make that clear, but still, it was there. There is something coming, and do, by all means, make your preparations now, if you can.
Yeah. Then my next question would be, is there something collectively that we can do through intense Kriya practice that we can alter that or at least delay it so that other people...
It's too late. And there are too few. This is something already we're practically... I mean, you can say that it's in time if you're a mile away from a precipice. But if you're already sort of halfway off the precipice, you can't say, all right, think positively. I think better think how to land safely. Okay?
Thank you.
Yeah. Any other? Have I discouraged everybody here?
No, you've got a volunteer here.
Swami, it's a great honor to be in your presence. This is kind of a follow-up to this gentleman's question. By the way, a comment for what it's worth. Polite disagreement. I don't believe there'll be any nuclear exchanges.
What's he saying?
He doesn't believe there'll be nuclear exchanges.
I do believe you're correct about great change, no doubt. And that's part of my question.
Whether we believe or not, whatever happens will happen.
Well, correct.
Yeah.
My question is, did the master ever speak of
earth changes and...
What did he say?
In the button was.
Did he ever talk about the return of Nibiru or Planet X, as it's been recently mentioned, that comes around every 3,600?
Did the master ever talk of earth changes, and specifically, did he ever talk of Nibiru or the planet that returns every 36,000
years?
He never talked of that.
Okay.
But he did say something. He was lecturing in the Hollywood church, and he stopped in the middle of a talk about the economy, which he talked about also. And he said, "You don't know what a terrible cataclysm is coming." So that means something.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Right.
Yeah, hi. You talked about being a playwright before, and I was just wondering what some of the topics are that you used to write about, and why, up until recently, why you stopped writing.
What were some of the topics that you wrote about when you were a playwright?
I gave up very soon, but I was trying to find... Basically, I was just working on technique, not on subject matter, because I wanted to have the subject matter clearly, more clearly under... So let me talk about two plays that I actually have written. and that I myself, and fortunately a few other people, really like. one is called The Jewel and the Lotus, and it is time in 200 years when Yogananda comes back to this body, to this world, I should say, and people are up in the Himalayas, and it's before his coming. And there's a merchant there who's very worldly, but also self-consciously worldly. In other words, he likes to make fun of himself. And, for example, somebody is talking about spiritual things, and he says, God is in everything, and God is in money, too. Of course God is in money. And, well, then, the more you have of money, the more you have of God. And that kind of reasoning, which is really quite fun. Then there's another one, which I wrote actually when I was 15, and then rewrote many years later. I went to Sedona at the Auberge. It's an inn there, and I took a little cabin, and I lived on Crystal Island, where this play was supposed to take place. And it was still fanciful, but there were five clans in this island, and one of them had attacked the others, and finally they had beaten him, and the one who was the general of this thing, he felt the inspiration to say, we want to stop war forever, so let's have a peace treaty. And all the other lords of the clans were all for it, except this little proviso for me. And those little provisos absolutely destroyed any possibility of a peace treaty. Now, when I was 15, I left it at that level. I was more pessimistic then. The war was going on, and I didn't see any hope for the world. In this one, the people rise up and say, we don't need a treaty. Treaties are made to be broken. And we need to a change of heart. And so let's think in terms of what will make it possible for us to live together in peace. Well, love. And so, anyway, it's a very interesting play. And I think it's well written, and I'm very happy with it. And I would love to see a movie made of it. And I've asked Jonathan if it can be, because there are only two scenes. And I know that movies like many scenes. I don't know how they could do it, but I've asked him to think about it at least. Because as a play, it has a very limited number of people who can see it. As a movie, movies are a wonderful medium. You can reach out across the world with them. Millions can see them. And you can have close-ups which show people's expressions. And I really think that this is a fantastic medium for reaching people with the truth. So I hope it'll be that.
I see.
Good morning, Swami. First of all, we just wanted to say thank you so much for conversations with Yogananda.
It was a joy. You know, he told me when he was talking, he said, now write that down, or write that, I've never said this before. And he wanted me to write down everything that he did. And when he had guests, he often usually would have me there to write things down. And so I have written Conversations with Yogananda, Essence of Self-Realization, The New Path, all sorts of stories I've told. And I'm the only person who's done it, and I can't figure out why the others haven't. Yes, Durga did, and Kamala did. What was her name? Silva.
Kamala did, yeah, Kamala.
And... But none of the others did. And they were all more about their own personal experiences, where I wanted to make it so that you could feel you could have been there too. So I've made those experiences open for everyone. Now, did you want to ask a question about it?
I do, yeah. It's two questions. The first question is about conversations with Yogananda. When it's just a little thing in there, one of the disciples asked him about UFOs. And yes, he said, what those people are seeing is true. And I just wanted to know if Yogananda had mentioned it all, because it's a hobby of mine. Anything with UFOs, and would we really, really have, you know, evidence that they're real in this lifetime?
He, who is this?
Yeah, did he mention anything about UFOs and anything?
He did.
That we might have evidence.
He
that
said
they're
it's
real.
Evidence I don't know about, but he said that they're true. There was one disciple who came out late one night and found in the deep little valley there on Mount Washington, right on our property, so a big spaceship, sort of a dirigent, how do you describe them? It's like a cigar shape. And he saw that there. Master didn't talk about these things much, but when he said they're true, there had to be some basis for him saying that they're true. Not only that, but he said that all of space is peopled. In fact, somebody told me, and I don't know if this is true, that he really said it, because the person who said it is not reliable. But nonetheless, he said that Master said, and I always asked him, did Master say this, or did you come up with it some other way? And if he said Master said it, okay. I think he said Master said it. All right. With all of that caveat, he said that they're beings on the sun. Their bodies are made of gas. I don't know, but it's most intriguing. At any rate, there's life everywhere. And there are plenty of planets to go to. When somebody was asking, why are there so many more people now than there were, say, 100 years ago? Well, there are lots of planets to come from. And he talked about that quite casually. One time I said to him, well, the people who are here in the present age of Dwapara, the age of energy, will they still be on the coming to this planet in the golden age? He said, oh, no. He said, I've told you, there are many planets to go to. You go where you're ready to work. So it'll be people, but not the same people.
The question I had was, have you or do you know of anyone that has experienced Yogananda coming back in the physical form to visit them?
Have you or do you know of anyone who has experienced Yogananda coming back in the physical form to
no,
visit them?
No, I have not. I do know of some. I know of at least two or three cases. But I was not. And about UFOs, I think that I'm the kind of person who, if a UFO were to land in my backyard, I'd be looking the wrong way. So.
Thank you for speaking with us. My question is, I see spirit in all and all in spirit. I regard Mother Nature and Father Sky as my gurus. My question is, can one have two gurus?
He thinks spirit is all and all is spirit, and he regards Mother Sky and the earth as his guru. Can one have two gurus?
You mean the sky and a man?
No, like Father Sky, Mother Earth.
Well, you can call them your gurus if you like. They are the gurus of most people. Most people have to be taught by their own experiences of life. Sky, earth, whatever. That's not the final guru. When you really want God, then I know people sometimes ask me, do I need a guru? I say, not at all. But when you want God desperately, then you will need a guru. A guru, as it says in the Bible, in the first chapter of John, as many as received him, to them gave he power to become the sons of God. To receive A great master like Jesus does not mean to write, state on a written declaration, I believe. Belief has been the proof or the test of Christianity for a long time now. It's a false test. People believed that the world was flat. That didn't make it so. We have to experience, we have to know. By receiving him, it did not mean simply believing in him. It meant taking him, his consciousness, into yours. His consciousness can lift you. You cannot get out of ego as long as you are in ego consciousness without the help of someone who is outside of ego consciousness. There is a story that Master told me of a man who was being bothered by a demon. And he used a certain mantra, a certain ceremony in the Vedas or whatever to get rid of this demon. And the idea was to impregnate some rice with that mantra and then throw this rice on the demon. And when he threw the rice at the demon laughed. He said, before you could even say your mantra, I myself got into that rice. And that was what he was saying. The ego is already infected with the delusion it's trying to get out of. So the ego can't get out of it. It'll always find some way of twisting it and turning it. It's only the consciousness of one. Anyone who is willing to take on such a job, and it's a job, it's no compliment to have disciples. It's a burden. But you, when you take that job on, you help to infuse that person with your liberated consciousness, and that frees you. Okay? Yes.
It's on. Okay. Swami, how do you, you know, in the world that we live in right now, the collective consciousness is getting faster and heavier. And how do you offer integration between, like, one's own spiritual meditation practice and living in the world and the consciousness that we're in right now? How do you...
Forgive me for being so deaf. I just have to have help. Please tell me.
The world is getting faster and heavier. How do you integrate a meditative practice with living in the world that we live in today?
You know, one thing I've noticed in Los Angeles is that there are two directions. One is much more spiritual. The other is much more worldly. And how do you integrate it? By creating a different reality. If you're surrounded by people who are only interested in material gain, it becomes very difficult. But if you mix with people who are spiritually inclined, like living at Ananda, it's really living in a holy place. You feel the vibrations when you go there. It changes your consciousness. And to be, the world itself is not becoming that way, but people's consciousness, it's a reality. I remember many years ago, I lived in San Francisco, and you could not tell from the sound in my apartment whether it was 3 a.m. or 3 p.m. I didn't hear traffic. It was a very quiet area. But at 3 a.m, I felt the quietness. It wasn't just an absence of sound. There was a feeling of peace because everybody was asleep. And so it is that people's consciousness has a definite effect upon others. And when you live with people, as we do at Ananda, who are all seeking God, that does have a strong effect. I remember one time I came back from Europe, I think, to Ananda, and I took a walk down below my home. And when I came back, I suddenly said, oh, it feels so peaceful. And I looked around me, I saw I had just crossed the border onto my property there. So, okay? Any other questions? There's a lady over here. You again.
I'd schedule a meeting with you if I could. If I'm to accept the concept that the dark times are still coming, and regardless what we do, it's still coming, and we can't alter that. Like the gentleman back here had a question for you, and you had answered, it's too late. So therefore, considering that there is a collective consciousness, and on a daily basis, if we're meditating and we want to help what's coming, would you suggest that we focus more on preparation and recovery collectively rather than prevention, because you're saying we can't prevent it now?
I don't think you can prevent it. I don't see what you can do. I'm doing my best, but my way of preventing it is telling a few people to get out if they will, because I think that there's going to be a very hard time here. However, this too I am doing, and it's a very important thing. Those who love God will be protected. And I have seen that happen in many ways in my life. So I strongly believe that those who, if you love God, even if you're in the worst situation, you will be protected. Okay.
Oh, sorry. I believe that as well. And which brings me to the second part of the question. When you're meditating, what intent would you advise us to do that you're doing to put out there with this as to raise the higher consciousness or vibration to this darkness coming?
What would you suggest that we do to put out the consciousness to raise, or the vibration to raise consciousness as we meditate?
What do you, in your meditation,
I would say
set
out? Well, I do it too. From my heart, I send out rays of love. I think love and bliss are the two things that will uplift mankind. Okay? Well, now I think that it's been going on long enough here.
Kalyani is going to sing.
Because we have to, no, I don't want to put it that way. We will have the opportunity to hear Kalyani sing. I think I see it. Okay.
Where would you like me to stand?
Right here.
Here.
And face them.
Face them?
Yeah, I'll hear you.
Did we take up an offering?
What's that?
He would like to take up an offering.
Better wait.
I'd just like to take up an offering, like to share the blessings. Of self-realization, any little bit helps us share this light. So we appreciate. We'll pass around baskets while Kalyani shares this beautiful song.
No, not before.
Before, sorry.
Kalyani asked me if I would give a little introduction for her. So while we're taking up the collection, it isn't so. Here, somebody could fix this mic. It's not so obtrusive while someone's speaking. Kalyani was, those of us who lived at Ananda in the very early years, the late 60s, early 70s, she joined our community at that time. And one of the things that Swami does so beautifully is he draws out the gifts that each one of us have so that we can share them and be a channel for God in that way. And Kalyani was blessed with an extraordinary voice that was uplifting and harmonious and beautiful. And we all had the pleasure and the blessing of hearing her sing for many years. This particular song that she's going to sing for us today was, she composed a melody to a poem that Swamiji had written, June in Ayodhya. Ayodhya was an idyllic kingdom of an ancient Indian avatar and king, Lord Rama. And Ayodhya was his kingdom, and it's symbolic of the perfect kingdom where people live in spiritual consciousness and harmony, and I think that's in part why Swami created these Ananda communities in this age, in this time of perhaps crisis and transition, to know that higher consciousness is still possible and people can live together in harmony. So Kalyani happened to come up one day on May 19th to visit the village. She hadn't moved there yet, and found to her surprise that it was Swami Kriyananda's birthday, and she had no gift to give him. So she composed this melody to his poem, June in Ayodhya, and sang it to him for a birthday present.
Listen, fair June is humming in the air, and drums Ayodhya sings of lasting peace. The growing grass nods heavy to the wind, patient till cutting time. The hay is stored, the fields spring up with adolescent plants, laughing flowers, berries, and graceful corn. In the orchards, every hand is quickly busy to catch the ripest fruits before they fall. Men's hearts are strong with that perfected strength that smiles at fences, turns aside old hates, nurtures true love, and finds such earnest pleasure in seeking truth that every private mind seems drawn to virtue. Like a public saint, the women's words are soft with kindliness. The children answer with humility. Even the men are like so many fawns, modest and still, sweet with complete respect. June in Ayodhya is so roused with joy, the earth can scarcely keep its boundaries, swelling with energy and waking strength, till not a mountain, not a valley sleeps, straining to burst and flood the world with laughter. Such harmony flows everywhere when men with grateful hearts offer their works to God. Then brotherhood needs no enforcing laws, no parliaments, no treaties sealed in fear. True peace is theirs to whom the Lord is near.
Okay, I guess that's it. Thank you, Kalyani.